And we back, and we back, and we back, and we, what is up? All right, welcome to Business Beyond Usual. My name is Ramu, and today I thought it would be interesting to sit down with some of my classmates who are managing millions of dollars in real investments during their MBA studies. How's it going, guys?
Hey, Ramu.
Hi, Ramu. Thanks for having us.
We've talked a lot on this show in the past about some of the experiences we have as MBA students in the classroom, hearing from professors, reading cases, debating with classmates. But I think what's really interesting about these funds and what I want to talk to you all about today is how real this all is, right? You're giving actual money to actual businesses at the school that has real stake in those businesses' success because of your decisions. No pressure, right, guys? Okay, so why don't you all introduce yourselves, what fund you're working on, and then I have some questions for you about what exactly being on those funds is like, what mistakes you've made, and how I can get seed funding for my personal project.
My name is Shelley. I'm a dual degree student at here at Ross doing my MBA as well as at the Michigan Medical School. And I'm currently the managing director of the Wolverine Venture Fund.
That's great. Matt Raskin.
My name is Matt Raskin. I'm a second year MBA. I'm the managing director of the Zelluri Commercialization Fund.
Hi, everyone. Allie Raymond, second year MBA, and I'm the director of operations for the Social Venture Fund.
Sweet. So I should go ahead and preface this episode with saying we're going to post in the show notes a webinar that was done early this year in 2018 that actually goes way more into detail about what each of these funds do, the application process, selection process. And so there's not a lot of kind of mundane material we're going to cover. A lot of that is in that webinar. I think you should definitely check it out. So today's show is pretty simple. I've got 10 questions for y'all. I'm calling the 10X return. Get it? No?
Clever.
Yeah, like it?
Clever.
Yeah, I came up with that myself. And then we'll end with some current event topics. Sound good?
Great.
All right, let's start with a toss-up in case any listeners aren't sure what this episode is about. Could someone give me a quick intro into VC, what the hell you guys do, and how a student-led venture fund differs from others?
Sure, I guess I'll take that. So venture capital at its core is about funding entrepreneurs. It's about making sure small, innovative businesses early on in their time on this planet get a chance to grow, get the money they need to grow, and really invest in making a solid, strong business. A VC fund typically has one or two general partners where they're the ones who run it, a number of limited partners who are paying money into it. The fund manages that money, invests in a number of different startups, and then when those startups are acquired or IPO, they get all of their money back and make a great profit, and everybody's very happy.
What about a student-led venture fund? Allie, how does that differ from anything else?
Yeah, I would say something that's really interesting about a student-led venture is that as students, we come to our prospective funds with a wealth of experience in prior industries and a background and a context, which we're able to add insight collectively. There's also a very different risk appetite. We are really doing this for an educational opportunity to better understand what would a hypothetical insert company in X field need to be successful. And because we're only here for 2 years, we're thinking about it in an immediate term screening capacity, whereas the fund, as a VC manager, would have to look a little more intensively on the holistic view of what would have portfolio returns, whereas we have the audacity to really screen and source the best deals that is happening at present.
That's awesome. So speaking of the student-led funds, I should say from Ross, we actually have 7 student-led funds. So you guys represent 3, but we also have, I don't want to forget anybody, a real estate investment fund, the Zell Early Stage Fund, Zell Founders Fund, and the Mazen Blue Fund. So combined, these funds manage $10 million. It's actively managed from you guys. I think that's pretty amazing. I should also disclose, Matt, I'm in the ZLCF with you. Matt is
my managing director.
I'm glad you picked me. So let's go ahead and move on. I'm interested to hear from you guys in your experience. What are some deals you feel like the fund missed out on or made a mistake with, and how do you rebound from that?
So I can take this one. This is actually a very interesting question because, like Allie mentioned, there's a 2-year turnover between, you know, every year there's new students that come on the fund. So sometimes when we make a mistake, we don't really see the effects of it till years down the line. And in that case, you haven't been present for when the due diligence was happening. So to give you an example, we did a due diligence on a company a few years ago. This is before I was on the fund. And we decided to pass on the company at the time and ended up seeing the company again when I was on the during my tenure on the fund. And actually, at that time, we looked at their diligence, thought it was pretty good, and then actually ended up changing our decision and investing last year in that company. So I think what's interesting about being on a fund that has high turnover, you don't really know what happened a few years ago, but you have to trust that your classmates, you know, made the best decision at the time, and that the next time you're seeing something, you have new information, you can make another informed decision. So yeah, that always happens, but it's part of the fun.
That's actually the benefit of having good structure in place within the fund, right? You guys probably have strong documentation. There is, you know, turnover, but hopefully from diligence to diligence and every year, you have kind of a running portfolio of information you guys can turn back to and make use of. What are some other resources you guys use in order to make an accurate assessment and a good due diligence?
I think we rely pretty heavily on just understanding what the investment landscape looks like, especially for impact investing. It's a pretty nebulous field with a lot of different silos. So a huge part of our educational undertaking is to make sure that we are up to speed on what sustainability investing looks like, what CSR investing looks like, what all the different types of urban revitalization investing looks like, all of which are very different fields. And so I think it's really having a strong alumni base that we can reach out to who are in the field, either as VC investors or impact investors, or as just subject matter experts, as well as a lot of like investor circle or a lot of just online materials, because we are figuring it out along with everybody else in the impact investing field.
In terms of resources that our fund uses, I want to just mention two like really big plugs for Ross. So one resource is our library here at Ross Kresge. We have a lot of amazing databases that I don't think other VCs in the area actually have access to. So things like PitchBook, ePharma, like eTrack, all those databases are actually really, really useful for our due diligence. And I think sometimes our board advisors look to us to get information because we have these resources at our fingertips. The second plug is the Michigan Network. You'd be surprised at how much deal flow, but also, like they mentioned, subject matter experts that you can find in the Michigan Network. So very often when we're doing a due diligence on a company, say it's a healthcare company, because I'm partial towards healthcare. It's very easy to get in touch with physicians at the hospital and get their opinion on something that we're looking at and see what their initial responses are. So two great things about Michigan is definitely the network and our resources that we have here.
What about you, Matt? What are some tools? What are some softwares?
We can go through the software and the tools and everything, but I'm going to have to sort of agree with Allie that the network is the most important thing. I can't count the number of really cool, interesting people I've gotten the chance to talk to, because you have to go there. You have to talk to people. You have to understand exactly what the environment is that these companies are operating in. So for the Zelleri Commercialization Fund, we're the earliest stage of these three funds. We tend to be looking at the most cutting edge and the sort of least well-developed of all the products that these companies are showing to the various funds. And so we have to go talk to people who know this area very well and might be like the most expert person in that area because it's so new. And it's really interesting to talk to these folks to understand what drives value, what do customers want from this new technology, and how can that technology be put into a product that really provides value.
Yeah.
So it's all about the primary research. The secondary research just fills in the gaps.
It's true. I think one thing you also talked about is that network and actually sourcing some of the information through other people. And, you know, from a ZLCF perspective, we work really hard on deal flow because we're trying to get companies in. We're still relatively young in the area. We're becoming more known. And so we're actively going to conferences. We're actively on LinkedIn, on Facebook, reaching out to entrepreneurs. We have good connections within the university from our mentors and our advisors with the engineering school and the med school. From you other guys, how do you guys manage deal flow and get companies in? Is it you guys are big enough now where people are knocking on your door?
We'd like to believe so. But I would say we have somebody on the fund who is the director of investments, and it's a pretty much a year-long commitment to constantly be sourcing the best deals, similar to you guys and the grassroots effort. But we also have strong relationships with a lot of incubators in different spaces that are sort of the pipeline program. And then here in Michigan, we work very closely with one of our co-lead investors, Bell Capital, who runs a yearly pitch competition for women-led ventures. And a lot of those people in that pitch competition come through our pipeline.
So I hope you guys liked how I just dove right into VC stuff. But let's retro and get to know you guys a little better. So Why did each of you pick your particular fund, and why did you get involved with the VC funds at Ross in the first place?
So I can take that first. I'm Shelley and the Wolverine Venture Fund. So funny story, actually, the summer before I came to Ross, I had never even heard of what VC is. I had no idea what venture capital was. But our fund is made up of not only MBAs, but also PhDs and other dual degree students. So we had MPH students, we have MD students. And one of the PhD students, you know, started talking to me and said, oh, well, we invest in a lot of healthcare companies. And if you're interested, like, we could always use a different perspective. And that's one of the reasons that I became very interested in the Wolverine Fund is you get to work with a lot of people, not just MBAs, and they bring a whole different perspective on the deal that you're looking at. So by chance, I applied and got into the Wolverine Fund, and it's been really fun to stretch my brain in a different way that I never had before.
So my path towards the Zelleri Commercialization Fund actually began sort of before I even got to Ross. Previous to Ross, I was working at a startup accelerator that had some VC funds associated with it, but I wasn't sort of part of those funds. I got to see the work they were doing. I thought it was really interesting, both from the finance and the business analysis side, as well as the fact that they're working with some very interesting tech. And, you know, very frankly, I am just a huge nerd.
That is true.
Fact.
So, so when I got here and I saw the opportunity to work at a very to work with a very early stage set of companies like the Zelleri Commercialization Fund does, we see a lot of really interesting brand new bleeding edge tech companies that are coming out of university labs and other sort of nearby resources. I had to jump at that opportunity because it's so fun to go find these companies, so fun to go hear about these sort of brand new, super awesome technologies that they're working with, and then thinking about how those can be translated into businesses that provide real value for customers.
It's so fun. It's so exciting.
It is.
I love
it's
it.
Very exciting. And for me, on the social venture fund, I think my interest in the fund is part and parcel of why I was interested in Ross overall. So they kind of worked in tandem. I have a number of years of experience prior to Ross in working in the startup space and working in international development. And I was continuously frustrated by the fact that there's just not sustainable development, sustainable funding sources, and that it just kind of feels like a dog pile for fast cash. And so I was really tired of this idea that it was a binary between doing good or doing financially well. And I think that there's a huge chasm between the two. And I think there's an opportunity to bridge that divide with the right minds. And so SVF invests in successful businesses that also have an impactful return. And I think that this is the fund that doesn't see them as a binary to each other. And it allows the opportunity to articulate what does impact actually look like. What should a financially viable trade-off be if there is one? And how do you rectify those two things?
Yeah, SVF is pretty unique. Are there a lot of student-led social venture funds in the country?
There are not. We are actually, we were the first student-led impact investing fund in existence. We were founded in 2009. And since our founding, we've talked to 37 other international business schools to help facilitate them forming their own impact investing, including those chumps over at Harvard and Wharton. They took their notes from us, thank you very much, of how we were operating. And we have been incredibly successful to date.
I kind of teed that one up a little bit.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Awesome. We got our soundbite in there.
What about the Wolverine? Wolverine, were you guys this is the first one at Michigan? What's the...
Yeah, we were actually the first student-led venture fund in the whole country.
Okay.
And we started in 1997 and have just grown since then. So we've seen a handful of exits since we started, and we're very excited.
All right. Well, Matt, can you beat that with anything?
Nope, we just follow these things.
All right, who's got the best fund and why?
Oh, man.
This is okay. So, obviously, social venture fund, duh.
Topic.
But I would also say that each one is special and unique, in part because it's not a competition. Each fund has its own investment thesis, has its own articulated viewpoint. And actually, the more investors that are in the space making holistic and thoughtful investments in different types of business, the better off investing as a field is. So it's not a competition, and you're lucky it's not, because we would obviously win at the social venture
fund.
Yeah. I think that's a really good answer. But I think one of the reasons we have so many is it's so popular. There's such a demand from a student side. I wonder, what do you guys feel like is such a draw for venture capital that draws people in as students? You know, knowing what you know now, I also wonder, is it still a viable pathway into VC out of B school? It's kind of tough to get into to VC, right?
It's very tough. It's very tough, and it's very tactical based on the skills that you have. And so I think all of the funds provide the students who are on the fund a great exposure to how to actually be a VC and to do tactical knowledge of all the experiential learning that comes with valuations, cash flow statements, metrics, management team assessment, all the things that are sort of fundamental to assessing what is a good business. But I would also say the leadership component of being on each of these funds makes you a more well-rounded candidate for any job post MBA.
I mean, just to chime in on that, I know there's at least two of the first year MBAs on the Zeller Commercialization Fund who are going to be doing internships in VC this summer, which is very exciting. So there definitely is still a career path. It is challenging. It's very network based, but the funds are the best place to build that network. We all have boards of advisors that are involved with some, are associated with some of the biggest VCs in this area, and you know, known well around the country. So it's a great place to start building that network towards the career. The leadership angle, unquestionably, I've gotten to work with some of the people who are so bright and curious that it really challenges you to show up at your best every single day. And that translates into work very, very well. It also gives you more repetitions, analyzing companies, analyzing their marketing, analyzing their strategy, their operations, their scaling potential. So you get a lot of chances to repeat this analysis of various companies, which helps to hone your skills for anything you might want to go into. If it's consulting, finance, marketing, tech, CPG, anything, this number of repetitions will get you really good at doing all that analysis, much more so than in many other cases in business school.
Yeah, that's true. I think, what is it, we've had two managing directors in the fund in the past that have actually jumped over because of their networks with VC companies and actually are working with them, right?
Yes.
Yeah. One of the things that I wanted to mention in terms of why there's such a big demand, well, it's really fun. It's way more fun than reading cases, I'm not going to lie. One thing that, I think there's a demand because it is real money and your decisions actually matter and the stakes are much higher when you're like, okay, this is like the equivalent of my student debt and I'm investing it in a company, so it better pay off. Another thing about going into VC right after business school, yes, it's very difficult, but it's definitely possible. There are a few people that we know in our class that have managed to network their way into getting a job. And then actually, I don't know if this is a good or bad thing, but a couple of the managing directors of the Wolverine Venture Fund actually left a few years ago and started their own VC fund. So not saying that it's impossible, because it is definitely is possible. But
you start your own VC fund.
Yeah, just start your own.
You win the lottery first.
I know. Yeah, right? Can I get that kind of money?
You got to get some network to get some money to start your own fund. But yeah, it's possible. So it really does give you real life experience that is very, very, basically you are a VC. So you're doing the real work.
Well, I totally agree with that interest aspect that drew me in. I think that for a lot of kids coming to B school, there is kind of like an allure, like what is VC? Like I really didn't know myself. And I don't know if I told you this, Matt, when I actually applied to SVF first, but they wouldn't take my application because I didn't go to one of the mandatory meetings.
We're sticklers. What can
so
I say?
I had to settle for ZLCF.
I don't know if you're settling. I think ZLCF is really awesome.
I think we won by getting you.
That's true. I'm so happy I'm in ZLCF. So I do think that let's move on to some other topics. I think one of the interesting aspects of a student-led fund is that you guys, the students, are in control of every part of the fund. And so I wonder, how has the fund changed since you guys have been a part of it? Maybe a new investment thesis, maybe new structure, maybe new deal flow process. You know, what has changed since you guys have been here?
I would say part of being a student-led fund is that every year you're going to have a new management team, you're going to have a new fund. And so it's kind of a back-end question because every year it's going to change. Every year it's going to be responsive to what's happening in the marketplace, what's the status of impact investing overall, and who are the students available to do it. One thing that I think we've seen a huge trend in is that traditional banking firms like Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, JPMC, all of these different types of funds that are being managed now have an impact component. And so we are sort of paying a little more attention to when capital is limitless, what are they putting their money towards and what are their criteria for impact and how do they assess that? And quite frankly, because they're so new at it, we feel like it's old hat for us. And so we're trying to redefine the ability to assess, given that there are some new players in the market.
Let's end with our last question. I probably asked you guys way more than 10, so I don't think 10x return was a good topic header. So it's something I always ask partners at my firm that started to specialize in whatever industry they were in was kind of how do they stay up to date? So I wonder from you guys, how do you specialize in a topic when there's so much content out there? How do you stay up to date with VC in the news? Are there certain websites, blogs, are there book recommendations? What do you guys have?
The most important thing is to read Venture Deals, which is by Brad Feld and Jason Mendelsohn. And then from there, it's sort of figure out an area that you're really interested in, whether it's social impact, whether it's, you know, for me, it's sort of technology and information technology, whether it's healthcare, and then dive deep into that. Go to TechCrunch, go to VentureBeat, just Google a bunch, and you'll find some interesting information. That'll help you sort of start to form opinions about that area because opinions matter. And opinions are what helps to define sometimes even expertise. You know, if you have an opinion and it turns out to be wrong and you learn from that, that's a piece of how you get better at it.
I would also just recommend finding other investors in the field that you're interested in and following what they're doing. A lot of times they'll do an annual report or they'll do a memo or a white paper on why they're thinking critically about whatever thematically is hot at the moment. Or conversely, what is dead, like apps are dead, as we'll talk about. But I would say that it's been really interesting just to get to know where people's head is at, because you would be surprised that there is a shocking lack of expertise, as you would traditionally call it. It really is just what's popular, what's hot, and what's the thinking around it. And you're going to have your own thoughts as well.
I think it becomes easier once you narrow down into something that you're really interested in. So for me, for healthcare, it's really interesting. Easy to stay up on it because there's only like a few big deals that make it to the press. My personal source of a lot of information is actually our faculty advisor, Professor Eric Gordon. He calls it a hobby, or rather his wife calls it a hobby, to interview with a lot of newspapers or like NPR or Financial Times and things like that. So he is often sending us his latest interview, and that's a good way for us on the fund to stay up to date with what's happening in VC deals. But after Ross, you know, you got to find your own blogs, TechCrunch. And I often read the news of some of the VC, the healthcare VC companies that I'm interested in. And they often publish a lot of what's hot and what's not.
I listen to Marketplace in the morning, and Professor Gordon is frequently featured on the pod. I have one more pod to throw out kind of as a side to keep you buffed up. A16Z, I think, is pretty incredible. It's from Andreessen Horowitz. It's the, you know, Mark Andreessen and Ben Horowitz, the two guys that founded a VC firm out in California. Pretty remarkable guys. And I think it's really great. About 20 minutes, various topics, strong deep dives into certain areas. They get really strong experts. So I like that one in the morning as well. All right. Well, speaking of VC and VC in the news, next segment, VC in the news. So I think we both, all of us came with one or two articles that we wanted to share. And so I'll start. This is from TechCrunch. It's called "There's an Implosion of Early Stage VC Funding and No One's Talking About It" from TechCrunch. This is actually from November of last year, but I kind of like the idea here. So the idea is that since 2014, the number of VC rounds at tech companies have halved from 19,000 to 10,000, but the drop in VC funding hasn't really been that dramatic, hasn't fallen that much. And what's actually happened, it's shifted to just later stage rounds. So early stage money has started to dry up. And the article attributes four main reasons. One is they say that the era of funding apps is over, SaaS funding has dropped, and fintech has seen quietly fall in activity. And the last one is VCs are doubling down on that winner-take-all leaders. And so I think one of the worries here for me is if there is a true shrinkage or true dry up in the early stage funding pool, that then entrepreneurs are going to be less inclined to want to start up a company if they know it's going to be very tough to secure money. And if VCs are trying to be smarter and kind of allocate their dollars to those unicorns, it can be tough to break in. I don't know if you guys have any opinions on that.
I mean, I'll sort of say that I think some degree there's a bit of right sizing and risk tolerance going on here. What you saw with these VCs that were throwing a lot of money out there at a bunch of different companies and sort of seeing what stuck was this willingness to willingness among entrepreneurs sometimes to fail quickly. They say fail fast, And sometimes, you know, those companies might have succeeded if they had just stuck around with it a little bit longer, but there was less aversion to a failed entrepreneur who went to go start another one and they could raise more money. I think now we're starting to see VCs realize that there's value to be had in sort of sticking through a potential downside rather than calling it right away. And so there's just a little bit more right-sizing that risk, and they're looking for the really solid companies rather than throwing a bunch of money at a bunch of companies and seeing what makes it through.
Makes sense. That's interesting. Yeah, we'll see how it kind of plays out. I think there's definitely a benefit. There also could be a negative side. So Matt, since you we talked about pre-seed, let's go right into you and your article.
Yeah, so my article also comes from TechCrunch. It was from just about a week ago about a VC firm in London, Kindred Capital, that has raised about 80 million pounds. They're structuring their fund in a very interesting way. They're once they've returned the money to their various investors, out of all the profit, they're letting the portfolio companies and specifically the founders of the portfolio companies take part in that profit, which, you know, does dampen the return for investors relative to what it would be if they didn't let the companies participate. But they think there would provide enough additional value in total profits earned to compensate for that. And the benefits they see coming out of this are incentives for the best companies to come to Kindred Capital. So now we have the very, very best companies tend to have, you know, many VCs competing for the money that they need to raise, competing to put money into the company because they see it as a really sure thing. So this provides an extra incentive for those best companies, those really, really great companies to come to the firm. It also creates a better community among the portfolio companies, allowing them to help each other. And it aligns incentives between the fund and the entrepreneurs because the entrepreneurs get to participate in some of those profits. So I find this structure very interesting.
It is interesting. Do you think that the fund as itself is doing this so that they can benefit from the deal term, so they can get a better discount rate, or maybe they can be able to have a better board seat later on? Like, doesn't this kind of like it's tit for tat? I'll give you equity in mine and get more equity in yours.
I think the argument is that it creates more total value for everybody. And it helps to fulfill one of the VC firm's requirements. It's not just about the money. It's also about providing value for the company. I'd be curious to think what Ali and Shelley think, though.
I'm curious about if you're, say you're a CEO of your own startup and you are now a co-investor, like, is there any sort of conflict of interest if this, like, VC is going to look at potentially a competitor to manage their risk in their portfolio, or, like, I don't know. I just feel like there's a lot of nuances to think about in terms of the structure.
Potentially. The article itself goes into some more complex terms that they have to sort of make sure everything is protected, to make sure that they're protected against sort of bad actors. But by and large, yeah, there's a lot of sort of other nuances that could go into this.
I also think about, like, a lot of times, even after a venture has secured funding, there's still this need to pivot based on market variables. And I wonder if there's this investment on the top line, how much is there an incentive to make sure that you're malleable to what's happening in the marketplace?
Yeah. Yeah. One thing we have learned is in any time we structure these deals and we talk about the terms, there needs to be an alignment incentive. So this is an interesting, you know, setup. It is intriguing. Let's see where that goes. Ali, why don't we move to you with your article?
So my article is from the Stanford Social Innovation Review, which is the place to go for all the hot social impact news.
Yeah.
Highly, highly recommend. Upvote. And it is from November of 2017, titled Impact Investing is Being Democratized and Marginalized Communities Are Benefiting. I think that this is an incredibly important context to sort of look at, in part because every week it seems like there's something else in the news about how women and minority-owned businesses are being underserved, underfunded. Just last week, Village Capital released an incredible report written by Cough Cough, a Ross and SVF alum, Ebony Pope.
Shout out.
Highlighting that a VC firm in the Valley responded to a Black female-owned business saying, I'm sorry, we can't actually back you, even though you've gone through due diligence, because we don't have proof of concept that other Black minority-owned businesses have succeeded. And so we don't want the risk. We don't have the risk appetite to fund you in consequence, which is only perpetuating the problem further. And so the idea of impact investing being open to more people and finding the vehicle to do that is sort of the thought around this article. It highlights an idea of Community Capital 500, which allows a Kiva-type crowdsourcing platform where people are able to provide small donations up to $10,000 to go earmarked directly towards businesses that are being led by women. And so I think, and minorities. And so I think it's an interesting space for impact investing overall, because as I had said earlier, there's a lot of new big bank mega capital partners in the impact investing space. And on the other end of the spectrum, more people are now being invested in putting their money towards organizations that are founded by women and minorities. And so it's a meeting of the minds, hopefully somewhere in the middle.
Yeah. Are those dollars, are those donation dollars, or are they getting a coupon payment back as investors?
They are getting a coupon payment back, and they're sort of democratizing sort of what is a VC. You're going to get a certain percentage. And so as the company exits, you would get a certain percentage of the overall same as we all would working with lead investors.
When I read that article, it actually made me think about this company called Quantopian. Quantopian is this, it's actually this open algorithm trading company. They let people kind of come in, develop trading algorithms on top of their platform. It's an open source platform to buy and sell securities. What's actually interesting is some of the algorithms they developed in-house, it actually allows people to come in and invest through these algorithms that are targeted towards certain specific things. So actually, you can check box and say, I don't want my money to go to guns. I don't want my money to go to terrorism. I don't want my money to go to the tobacco companies. And actually, the dollars will be reattributed based on the fund type to where you want your dollars to actually go. So now you're actually putting your dollars where you want from a social perspective. And they're empowering the investor, kind of like this is empowering individuals to give back in the right way, give back in a social way. Because honestly, you give to Vanguard into your mutual fund, you really don't know where those dollars are going at the end of the day once they get distributed out to their portfolio companies, right?
And honestly, that was the impetus for the Bank of America, the JPMC, to really start to look at impact investing as a response to our generation of millennials really raising their pitchforks toward the bank, saying that this needs to be more equitable. And honestly, it's not as if it's a moral imperative to invest in minority or women-owned businesses just for the sake of it, because it's the right thing to do, even though obviously it is. It's really that you're missing out on an opportunity of an underserved market that has been historically underfunded. And I think from a business school sense and from a business imperative overall, it allows for the opportunity to really build a new venture and to be a first mover. And just to acknowledge, like, historically, a lot of these pipelines aren't built to be sort of conducive or to have the like funding network that white men in this country are necessarily going to have. And so I think just recognizing that that institutionalism exists and sort of what can we do to build a better pipeline that isn't going to be talked about at the whatever water cooler cocktail party, whatever the euphemism we choose to use.
One of the interesting things they mention in the article is that humans have an unconscious bias, particularly in VC, to invest in people that look like them. And one of the cool things about this is when you have a larger number of investors, when you're crowdsourcing investment, it's naturally going to be much, much, much more inclusive because there's so many more people out there. It's going to be more representative of the sphere of entrepreneurship and the sphere of the United States, the sphere of the world. So that's a really positive thing to come out of this kind of a structure.
And honestly, the pipeline for leadership in the VC space starts with our fund. Candidly, Social Venture Fund has historically been very dominated by the ladies such as myself.
Yeah.
Our management team is 4/5 female, and our fund is about 60% female with a high indication of underrepresented minorities as well.
And I'll chime in that the Zeller Commercialization Fund, out of 35 people, 17 are women, 18 are men. So we're right at a 50-50 split outside of having an odd number of people.
So the Wolverine Fund is also a 50-50 split with half women, half men. And then our board, which is our 5 main members, 3 out of the 5 are women. So go us.
All right. Let's move on. Last one.
I'll finish off. I actually selected 2 articles because the Wolverine Fund is always doing the most. So the first article that it's actually from Forbes, and it's highlighting why healthcare startups are attracting the most VC dollars in the Midwest. So one of the really amazing things that they highlighted is that in 2017, the 5 largest deals ended up being like over $870 million in investment with a collective valuation of $7 billion. So that's a huge amount for the Midwest and in general to have all be in healthcare. So the reason that I think this is really exciting, I'm from the coast, I'm from New York, and so thinking about that, not only are there startups in the Midwest and VC funds, but it's actually attracting VC companies from the coast. So your big ones like NEA, Bessemer, things like Flagship Ventures that are on the coast are now coming to the Midwest and are a lot more interested in the Midwest companies. So that's a huge plus. I think I'm going to be in the Midwest for a long time. So
yeah,
it's a good sign. But one of the really exciting things about healthcare that is just highlighting that it's booming. Like healthcare has a lot of problems and a lot of people are trying to fix it. A lot of startups are popping up everywhere, all over the country. And the nuances with healthcare is very different from tech in that you're not just selling to the patient or the customer. You actually have to satisfy a lot of other stakeholders, including, you know, the doctors, the nurses, as well as the payers. So who's going to pay for your new technology? So now becoming a successful entrepreneur in the healthcare space is much more complicated, but it also leaves a lot of opportunities for people to try.
What do you guys know about the Midwest scene in terms of, because there's a saturation of dollars in New York and San Francisco. So I don't know, are there dollars coming here? Is there more deal flow happening in the Midwest?
So I can speak to that a little bit. As I alluded to, my previous job was at a startup accelerator, and that was in Cleveland. So I'm relatively aware of the Midwest startup scene. One of the really cool things about being in the Midwest, both sort of Ann Arbor, Cleveland, Detroit, is that there's a huge amount of population within a relatively short radius of here. So it's really great for things like healthcare because healthcare is strong where population is strong, and there's a really good correlation there. So those innovations tend to happen here because there needs to be a lot of healthcare to support this amount of population. One of the really interesting stories is a company called CoverMyMeds, which became Ohio's first unicorn. I believe it was January of last year when they sold to McKesson for either $1.1 or $1.2 billion. Just to give you an indication of the success that healthcare companies are seeing in the Midwest because they're so close to their customers, and then they can attract the funding from the coasts.
That's interesting.
And what I would sort of say, especially from an impact lens, is I think there's no better place than being in Detroit's backyard to sort of really assess what are viable alternatives to make an impact and to have a strong business. Detroit is in the midst of a very strong revitalization, and more people each year are moving back or moving to the city, bringing their dollars with them, especially from places like San Francisco, where I'm from, or New York, where Shelley's from. And in a lot of ways, like that infusion of capital is allowing businesses to really take off the ground, as well as challenge and try to address some of the mitigating social behavioral issues that have caused institutional injustice. And I think that that's not just in Detroit. I think that it's a narrative that's in a lot of Rust Belt cities. And I think something to be said about the Midwestern work ethic is that they're scrappy and they're gritty and they're used to sort of like rolling up their sleeves and getting the work done. And I think that that leads to an explosion of startups.
Sweet. Well, that is your VC in the news. I think that's going to do it for us today, guys. I want to thank Ali, Matt, and Jelly for joining me today. Thanks, guys.
Thank you for having us. Yeah.
And thank you for listening. We'll put the links of all our stories and resources we discussed in the show notes, and so check those out to follow up. If you like the show, please subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you get your podcasts and leave us a review. I want to give a quick shout out to one of our listeners, Andres. He sent us an email last week just to let us know that the show's been helpful for him as he's navigating the MBA application process. It's great to hear from you, Andres. Thank you for the kind words about the show. We love doing it. We love hearing from you, too. If you have an idea for a topic or feedback for the show, or you just want to say hi, feel free to drop us an email at bbupodcast@umich.edu. Again, that's bbupodcast@umich.edu. Business Beyond Usual is brought to you by the Roth School of Business at the University of Michigan. It is produced by me, Ramu Anomaly, and Christopher Anke. Jonah Brockman did our recording and audio mixing today. Until next time, I'm Ramu, and this is Business Beyond Usual.